The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And this is one that we should have done years and years ago when he was the winemaker for Malivoire. And now I am joined by the wine growing director, GM, and team principal of Malivoire Wines, maybe other titles, Shiraz Modiar. Shiraz, thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Matt, thanks for having me here. It's great to actually, like you say, finally put this together. And in the time that that we have been talking, yeah, I've given myself all sorts of titles over the years, from obviously winemaker, that's a nice easy one, but then moving into general manager, which sounded kind of boring. So hence I'm a F1 guy, and all the guys that lead the teams are called team principal. So I'm like, hey, this is a team, I'll be team principal. And so that was kind of fun, but you know, you still needed the legitimate general manager title. And now I'm going back to it because, you know, I like getting my hands dirty, whether it's in the vineyard, in the soil, or in the cellar with the wine. So now I've created a new title, which is, I don't know which sounds better, director of wine growing or wine growing director.
Ooh, that's a good question. And there is something, because it's like, I'm in charge of the wine growing it.
Yes.
It does give this almost deity-like control of nature feel to it.
Well, that's what I am.
Yeah. Because as you know, being a winemaker, you are in complete control over the environment around
you. Absolutely. There's nothing that goes astray in the vineyard. Absolutely nothing.
I want to go back. Shiraz, did I mispronounce your last name?
No, Matiar. You got
Matiar. Oh, my God. That's a, trust me, on Vegas, everyone who bet me to get it wrong, they lost a lot of money. There's so many places to go. But actually, let's start with the, what's the first thing here? We have your sparkling. We got a whole bunch of your wines to try. So we're going to bounce between talking about the portfolio of Malivoire. By the way, people don't know, we're at the winery, Niagara, Beamsville Bench, very easy to get to, very pretty. These guys, I'm going to do a gross generalization, Chardonnay and Gamay, with certainly Gamay. If I had to do the calling card of Malivoire, would it be fair to say Gamay would be the base of everything here? Not the base of everything, but the tip of the spear for you guys.
Absolutely. Yeah, you got it right. I mean, we love Gamay. There's some funny stories behind it, because Gamay wasn't the original intention here. It was really Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and a rosé. Gamay was planted as the base for rosé until our very first years of taking fruit off the vine, and we're like, wow, this is really exciting. So we started making red out of it, and before we knew it, we were like being far well known for our Gamay than our other reds. So we just said, you know what, this is the gods are speaking here, and they're saying Gamay and Malivoire are the perfect fit. So
good on you guys to have that sort of flexibility, because when you guys started, Pinot is an easier sell than Gamay for the general public, you know, not for the winers. Oh, Gamay, that's Beaujolais. And then, you know, we start mentioning all the crews. But yeah. I mean, good for you guys for realizing that and making, you know, that sort of philosophical shift.
I think that's part of what has been very cool about here. If you haven't visited Malivoire, please do. It's a very unique spot. Very easy to get to, but also very easy to drive by. So you got to get your, you know, make sure you're looking on the roadsides, because you can so easily drive by, because we're sort of tucked into the bench here. But as you kind of drive up the driveway, it's like Mother Nature has talked to Frank Lloyd Wright, and they're going, yeah, compress and expansion, you know. So that's what it is like when you come in here. It's like it's really tucked in, and all of a sudden the sky opens and you're here on the bench.
It's so true, because you'll be driving on King and you're like, oh God, Waze says I'm getting close, and you're going 78 kilometers an hour because it's easy, even though it's a 60 zone, and then the last second you see it. The amount of people that either hard turn in or have to do an annoying 3-point turn or U-turn before they get here. But then a second, you know, you go up the hill, and then everything goes from anger at Waze to, oh, This is delightful the moment you arrive here.
Yeah. So, and it's a really cool spot. Again, we've always done things a little bit differently. We have the Gravity Winery. You know, our retail is positioned sort of down low, sort of in a bunker almost. It's not really taking advantage of the beautiful view that we have here. But it gives a very different sense, almost a European sense of I'm in someone's cellar tasting wines with them. So we've always done things a little bit differently, but we've also always been ready to change and adapt. That is something, you know, if something's not working right, you pull the plug and you change. And so, yeah, having that opportunity to go, yeah, you know what? This red, it should be our flagship, not this one. I think that was really cool. You know, we've turned some of our best sites into sparkling and rosé. So it's you know, we're constantly learning from our surroundings, putting our best foot forward on what represents us best.
Before we do the Shiraz origin story, what's the sparkling here we're having?
So we're tasting our Che Bello, and Che Bello means how beautiful in Italian. And this is we created this wine, I want to say 6 or 7 years ago, just wanting to make a beautiful, easy drinking sparkling wine made in the Charmat method, and very much inspired by Prosecco, so hence the Italian name. And what we were really excited about was the opportunity to find a grape variety that is native. When I say native, you know, it's as a close approximation as you can make for a native variety in Ontario that's not a wild vine. But this is made with Sauvignon Blanc. What I like to call the heritage varieties of Ontario, because it's been planted here since the 50s and 60s. Really kind of the base of the first wave of better wines, table wines in Ontario in the 70s. It's still out there and it's still great. It ripens really early, so it fits in the sparkling program, and it's got beautiful aromatics and a lot of fruit to it. So it just makes the perfect kind of base wine for a very easy drinking sparkling. And at the time of the day that we're tasting it right now, there's nothing better.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. For tasting this at 9:08 a.m., nice moussey in the middle, good soft fruit, doesn't have sometimes that bad sweetness you will get in mass-produced Prosecco. There's still much more of a linear acidity to it. It's a lovely way to start the interview.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just a good way for us to prime our palates. And you know, sparkling has become a growing concern, not just for Malivoir, but I think for a lot of wineries in Ontario. We do have this beautiful, cool climate we love to shout out about, and sparkling and cool climate is a perfect fit. We can do so much. I'm surprised there's not more sparkling-only wineries in Ontario, but I think that's a growing trend because people love it. And like now, you can drink this stuff all the time, any time of the day.
So let's now go back to you. And as we do this, it's so nice. We've got a whole bunch of wines. So Shiraz is carefully going through the different ones. The next one will be a rosé. By the way, before the journey, and I keep saying before the journey, I noticed there was a rosé. Like, is that after Moira Rose? Is that what that was named after?
A lot of people think that. So we have a rosé that we call the Rosé Moira.
It must have come out before Schitt's Creek.
It did. It came out in 2013. And we wanted to create this rosé that was very inspired by Provence. You know, very pale, very elegant, quite rich. And, you know, the type of rosé that is perfect, you know, on a yacht. But mm-hmm. We don't have yachts around here. But anyway, the inspiration was there. Made this beautiful rosé from the Moira Vineyard. So in my mind, I would have called it the Moira Rosé. But for some reason, Martin, who I don't know what happened, but he said, no, let's not call it the Moira Rosé. Let's call it Rosé Moira. And so, and Moira is the name of his partner, and the vineyard is named after her. So that was totally fine. And then a couple years later, Schitt's Creek comes out and doesn't come out with the Rosé Moira, but comes out with the Moira Rosé. So I just thought that was so funny. And a lot of people, you know, they actually come here just to buy it as a lark. And hopefully they enjoy great rosé and realize how great of a wine it is. But it is kind of funny that we did come out with it a couple years before Schitt's Creek, but we've benefited from it.
Absolutely. So I know you'll probably have to put the mic down as we're going to be trying, I believe, a sparkling rosé.
Yeah, I just realized I had one other rosé before.
No.
Yeah.
If you want to pour it, that's great. I can easily just vamp for a quick second. My main job is in sports talk radio. And by the way, there'll be a couple times where we just stop as we're pouring and trying something, and I appreciate this. The crazy thing is, this is my first time coming here, and it's shocking that I haven't been at Malabar before, because this is one of the more important wineries when you want to tell the story of Niagara, and specifically when you want to tell the story of the bench and of this very specific reason. And it is such a, like, just a nice, cool, more old school tasting bar. It does have a more Italian feel. So let's get to it. 1997, was it around then you went to Brock and you were part of like their first of the new wine program?
Yeah, that's great. 97 was when Covey's first students joined the program. And so there was a small, I think.
And Covey, by the way, for people who don't know what that is.
Cool Climate, Enology, and Viticulture Institute at Brock University.
I wanted to say Covey. That's much easier. That's a lot of syllables.
It is. We use the English Canadian spelling of Enology with an O. The Americans just use an E. Anyway, that is our research institute and Brock University, with a lot of direction from local industry to get research and education here within the Niagara industry was a great thing, and I'm eternally grateful that it came about, because I was looking for an opportunity to study wine, and my interest was driven by my name. I don't know why my parents chose the name that they did, but it obviously had a very
was that a coincidence? I didn't want to do the I'm sure you've answered it so many times, so you can just say yes or no. We'll move on. Yeah. Was it a pure coincidence? Okay, yeah. Moving on. School.
But so then I get into the program, and it's a 4-year program, but almost every one of us had at least our first year science courses behind us. So 3 years to get through the program. And then as soon as I graduated in 2000, I love to do the Conan O'Brien in the year 2000.
Do you have the falsetto to do that?
I could, but I'm not going to. It might not sound good on the podcast, but I jumped at the opportunity to work here because Malabar had just started. They opened their doors in 1999. The winery was built in 98. The first vines were planted back in 1996. So it was a good progression, the right sort of progression to get started. And so after I did a very early tour of the winery back in 1999 as a student, I thought, wow, this is really cool. I actually had did a little reconnaissance trips up to here back in 97 and 98, because we heard about this rumblings of this really cool winery that was being developed, you know, utilizing gravity on the side of a hill. So I had to come check it out. So yeah, as soon as I graduated, I came here, and Ann Sperling, the winemaker at the time, gave me the job as part-time cellar rat, if you will, and the rest is history.
Well, let's go back to a little more history. How'd you fall in love with wine in the first place?
Well, again, you know, it was my name. A lot of people would say, hey, we tasted you. And so I would start to taste wines. I mean, back in the day, I was not at all a connoisseur of wine. But I think growing up, I had a good sense of flavor and balance and food. You know, when everyone else was eating the same kind of boring dishes, my mother was creating a lot of Indian, but also French inspired cuisine. So growing up, I kind of got a sense of good food. And I think once I got to taste wine with food, that was where it really kind of sank in. I think I was in Montreal with a friend who was going to McGill, and his parents happened to be in town and took us out for dinner, and just tasting, and I can't remember what I tasted, but you know, I remember I was having duck and sweetbreads. I learned what that was real fast, but I remember
it's not
the
sweet. Spoiler alert: it's not a bread that's sweet.
I was 19 or 20 at the time. Anyway, I I really love the pairing of food and wine, and so that always kind of stuck with me. And then after I finished my first degree, which was in psychology, I was obviously looking for something interesting, and I just stumbled upon the program. And you know, at that point, I had started to get to know Niagara wines a lot better, just because, you know, you start to look in your own backyard and discovered like Vineland Estates and Councilman and 30 Bench that were just as like 30 Bench was just new, but it was really some great wines. I think I remember the Chardonnay and went from there.
So let's talk about the sparkling rosé. The first impression I have is soft power. It's a soft red fruit, but you know, you get the power of what you're trying to do with that sparkling. It sits there and it lingers. But what are we drinking?
So this is our Bizou Rosé. It's a non-vintage wine. That means there's opportunity to blend a little bit of base wine from previous years. This is all Pinot Noir. It actually comes from two farms, mostly the estate vineyard right here. So as you drive into the winery, you see these vines that are growing on the side of the hill. That's Pinot Noir, and we use that for this wine, for sparkling. And there's a little bit that also comes from my own farm. I have a clone. It's not really a clone. It's more of a selection of Massal, but it's a very slow ripener. So it's actually perfect for sparkling. So between the two of those blocks, we make this really fantastic Pinot Noir. We ferment it in barrel. So you get a little bit of that richness. There's the lees contact by sitting on the barrel. The barrels are very old, so you're not going to get any flavor of the wood. You're just going to have a really nice vessel for preparing the base. And then after that, it's 2 years on the lees in the bottle before disgorging. So again, you've built up a little bit of structure, so that's where you get a little bit of the power. But certainly the fruit is red fruit. It's cherry, it's raspberry, it's strawberry. It's really nice, distinctive rosé sparkling.
And that's, what does that retail for?
I'm going to say $40.
Yeah, it looked like 40, but the four, you know, looked a little, I couldn't really read it, so I wanted you to say it and not me. I will say this, it is something that I've noticed over the years, is you can get high-level sparkling, as you mentioned earlier, not, you know, here, 13th Street, Henry Appellum, for like around this price point. It does amaze me where these sparklings go through the same procedures as what you would find in champagne, and yet, you know, you'll get them for prices far less than you will. And I'm not saying, oh, these are all as good as Krug and Solana and stuff like that. People aren't getting ripped off is what I'm trying to say in terms of the price point versus the value versus the quality of what's going into the sparkling.
Yeah, absolutely. To me, it's still amazing value. Obviously, it's you know, we're not internationally known for sparkling in Ontario yet. So, you know, there's a limit to how high we can price it that works for our consumers. But I think people should not be afraid of what looks to be more expensive, because if you try to get something of equal quality, say from champagne, you'd be spending a lot more money.
And the next one that we are going to do is rosé. People need to know, Shraz doing a great job. Like right hand, he is able to open the bottle and pour while holding the mic in the left hand. In terms of multitasking, A+.
Thank you, Matt.
Yeah, you're doing a great job. At some point, I won't do this cheesy vamping that I'm doing as you are pouring the wine. By the way, kind of side note here, Anne Sperling, she really, like, her impact over all of this area is quite remarkable, isn't it?
It is. I think before, I'll only talk a little bit of the history that I remember. Before, she was obviously in BC at Cedar Creek.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then she started making her own wine.
Yeah. And then their family, Pioneer Market, where they started a winery, Sperling Vineyards. Of course, when she came to Ontario, she, I think, started in a industrial winery, but then moved over to Creekside quite quickly, and then to Malabar right after that. I think she saw the opportunity with this new startup and really put her stamp on how these wines were going to be made, and I had, you know, such a privilege to work with her for 6 years.
It also speaks to just what Malabar is, because like Anne and her husband Peter, they're really good at what they do.
Yeah.
So if they say, "Ooh, I think I'd like to work there," that's, you know, sort of the mark of, you know, that you're doing something right. What were those first couple of years like for you? You're done Brock, you're done your studies, now you're a seller rat.
You're making me think back 25 years, man. Oh my God.
You could make it up. What am I going to do? Call you out on it? Ah, that's not true.
It was fun. Yeah. I'll tell you what was fun is, so the winery was designed based on the vineyard capacity. So we, you know, we have 50 acres. We're going to produce, you know, however many tons, the 150 tons on average, maybe a little less. And that produces, you know, about however many cases. I'm trying to do really fast math in my head, maybe 12,000 cases. In the first few years, we were only doing like maybe 4,000 or 5,000 cases. We did a little bit of a custom crush for a few of the other wineries that were starting up at the time, but having that small volume allowed me to really take my time and learn and try different things in terms of how to move wine with gravity, which was kind of fun. You know, it's not the easiest thing to do. You had a lot of struggles, and, you know, sometimes things would go really slow, and we're hoping you would be out of here by like 6 o'clock, and you're here at 9 o'clock still trying to get something done. But and this is outside of crush. But outside of that, it was a lot of fun. You know, I was, you know, mobile and I'm still am, but you know what I mean? Like, I could run up and down the stairs on a ladder and climb on top of a tank and in a tank and jump out of it really fun and fast. So, those were the early days.
It's a physical job, isn't it?
It is. What was also interesting, though, just wanted to add to it, is at the time when I started, Martin Malvoir, the owner, he was still working his real job, which was a special effects producer, doing a lot of stuff in Toronto. He always had a bunch of films on the go at the time. So he would be gone for a few months and then he'd come back, and, you know, he didn't like to be still. So he would then invest in doing something in the winery. So, you know, sometimes he would leave work on a Friday and then come back, and all of a sudden, you know, there's something new that's just shown up at the winery that Martin built over the weekend. And so there was always lots of little surprises that came with working here in the first few years. As the winery kind of filled in, you know, maybe a new tool, maybe some new tiles, whatever the case may be, a new wall, a new cupboard.
Yep.
You're like, what? When did that happen? So, yeah, it was fun.
Now, if people can hear in the background, what's going on above us in some of the giant stainless steel tanks?
Yeah, so Dan Stauch is upstairs. When you're sitting down here, you can look right into the cellar upwards. We're putting our Gamay blend together. Mm-hmm. So that's our biggest volume wine of the season. And so we need all three of our biggest tanks to put that together. So you can hear Dan moving around fittings and hoses to kind of set up for that.
I so want to say, because I want to talk about the rosé now, David, turtle pet not make, but I'm not going to do that. God, oh, that's another thing. The amount of Schitt's Creek references that must happen when people are visiting here. Ah. Oh. I imagine the staff at some point is like, "Hey, we heard that joke earlier. We get it."
I hope the staff are well experienced with the show.
Yeah.
Admittedly, I have not seen every episode of every season. I just watch glimpses as my wife or my daughter are watching it. So,
listen, you're in charge of the weather here and viticulture. Yes. and all winemaking. You can't binge watch a show.
There you go.
What do I need to know about the rosé?
Gorgeous, gorgeous rosé. Very dry. It really has a long finish to it. This is from the 2024 vintage. We're tasting this in spring of 2026, and it's still beautiful. This is the one rosé that I would say you can actually age a rosé, even though it's in a clear glass. And so what that means to me is just make sure you keep it in a dark spot if you are going to age rosé for more than a year. But this is looking beautiful. Again, it's very similar to the fruit and the aromatics of the sparkling rosé. You know, kind of that cherry and raspberry notes. Beautiful expression of Pinot Noir, in my opinion.
Yeah. It must be crazy how different when you're driving here, when you're just going around Niagara, how different the winery scene is today versus, your first days as a seller rep?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there's so many smaller operations out there now. There's, you know, younger individuals that are just making bold styles of wines or creating a really exciting project, I think is great. There's more opportunity to do what we call virtual wineries. So, you know, we've got a couple places in the region where people can just set up and if they can find the fruit, they can make the wine and create a brand. And then you can be really, really, you can take risks, I think. You know, it's so the diversity of wine is fantastic. You know, when I started, it was just all about Riesling and Merlot, maybe some and Chardonnay, obviously. But it was all fairly similar in style. You know, that Riesling had this much residual sugar and that Chardonnay had a lot of oak. And so now the diversity of wine styles is just immense.
Yeah, it really is. I would be curious to see what that rosé there tastes like over the next couple of years. You know what we'll do? We're going to put the mics down for a second. You can pour the next wine, okay, and then we'll pick it up in one moment. And we are back. Before we talk about the Chardonnay that you've poured, I'm wondering, I hear it all the time, and I don't think I've ever asked a follow-up. For people who don't know, what does it mean when gravity, and we all understand what gravity is, if you walk off something, you fall. But what does gravity mean when it comes to winemaking?
Yeah, good question. So Malivoire, we're built on the side of a hill, so we have multiple levels. In fact, we have five levels going down, and actually we run the wine back up, and so it comes down twice. So really you can say we can use, you know, upwards of 10 levels. But what it means is the fruit starts at the top of the winery. For every stage where we have to move the, whether it's the fruit or the must, which is sort of the crushed fruit that's fermenting, or the finished fermenting juice, or, you know, after it's moved from the press, you've got to move it to another vessel. So you got to go from tank to tank to tank. You don't keep the, you know, the grapes in the same tank because you got to get it off the skins. You got to get it into the press. So every step of that stage usually is moved by some sort of mechanism, whether it's a must pump with an auger in it, or maybe it's a peristaltic pump, or maybe it's just with a forklift and a bin. You got to get it moved from one place to another. So by having us built onto the side of the hill, we can just start at the top and go from stage to stage down the hill. So we start with grapes, we destem into, say, a fermenter. That all happens as it falls down to the next level. And then after fermentation is done and we want to press that, it just falls to the next level, and that's where our press is. And then from there, we want to age in a barrel. Well, that's at the bottom, so we just drain it down to the bottom. And so, again, we're not using a pump. We're just using gravity. What does that mean? Well, obviously, we're saving energy, which is a bit of a plus. But, you know, maybe physical energy is a little bit more, personally. But it is a plus. But more importantly, by not having the skins or potentially the seeds go through the pump and get sheared or crushed, you don't extract some of the bitter phenolics or bitter flavors that you don't want in the wine. So you really preserve the freshness and the fruitiness of that wine. And at the back end, like right before bottling, sometimes you'll put the wines together and you're like, oh, you know, it's still a little bitter or something. And so, well, we can add this to the wine and fine it out. Well, we don't have to do that. So, and every time you do a little bit of fining, you're going to take more than what you want to take out of the wine. So by not having a fine at the end, we actually preserve everything that we want to keep in the wine. And that's the benefit of gravity.
Thank you. That's great. I've never asked that question before. And I've heard it been mentioned on other pods, gravity. I'm like, oh yeah, gravity. But and like, I understand what it is, but then, you know, you kind of want to get it out to everyone else. I would say if I think about Niagara and if I think of the bench, Chardonnay is always consistent. It's always a killer.
Yeah.
You know, what is it about this area? Because I was smelling the Chard and it just had a big smile on my face as you were giving that answer. What is it about this area that works so well for
Chardonnay? We've got so much going for us in Ontario and in Niagara. Obviously, we have a cooler summer, and certainly our proximity to Lake Ontario keeps our summer days a bit cooler, and that keeps the fruit really fresh and vibrant. So, you know, if you're in a hot climate, your Chardonnay might go a little overripe, so you get mango and pineapple and beyond. Whereas here we keep, you know, we keep this fresh acidity, so we have, you know, green apple and we have pear and we have plum and there's citrus notes like grapefruit and lime. And so there's this energy to the wine. And what I love is that we get everything in balance in Niagara with Chardonnay. So when you get the potential alcohol, the acidity, the flavors, the aromas, they all kind of come together. And that doesn't happen in a lot of places in the world where you get ripeness and you get acidity and balance all together. So we're so lucky to get that. And it's very much because of our climate, but we also have these wonderful calcareous soils because of the Niagara Escarpment and all the limestone. You know, this was very much of an ancient seabed many years ago, and all that calcium carbonate that's in the soil is what makes the vines, A, they grow very well, but B, they just give the fruit this real beautiful tension that, again, is why I think Niagara and Ontario Chardonnays are just outstanding.
Brag about this one, the Moro Chardonnay. I mean, just the saline notes at the end, but just this beautiful, just a beautiful nose on this Chardonnay. And I hate to ask the question the same way every time, but, you know, when people come by here, if they look at this bottle, if at the LCBO and they see it, what would they be getting?
Oh, this is fantastic. And actually, I haven't tasted this wine in a while. This is a new release, a 2024 Moira. So Moira Vineyard is the very first property planted for us on the bench. And so these vines are now over 30 years old. They're 32-year-old vines. And I think you have to really celebrate old vines because the roots go down very deep. And you get this beautiful length. It's crazy how the length of this wine just keeps going. And I think it's part of that is the age of the vines themselves. But you're getting, first, it's texture right off the bat. You know, it's just has this seamless feel, but this silky richness to it as well. And then the flavors, I start to taste, you know, and it's funny, I get sort of those leasy notes. So I get the biscuit and sort of the brioche notes, but then it's filled out with a lot of the fruit. And again, I'm getting a lot of peach and yellow plum, but it finishes with this really zesty crispness to it. So I'm left with this lime grapefruit finish, and it just keeps going, and that's where it just keeps going and going. And I haven't even talked about the nose yet, so give me a second. I didn't get a chance to
get your nose in there. And it's funny, it's there's so many great producers of Chardonnay in this area, and there's certainly differences between here versus if you're more Niagara on the lake. And it's another thing great for people out there, if they want to try different expressions of Chardonnay, you can come to Niagara, and Beamsville Bench is going to be different than St. David's, which is a wonderful thing.
100%.
Nose on this wine.
Yeah, beautiful. I mean, there's a bit of an orange blossom happening, and then again, I get into that peach and even a little bit of pear as well. But it's just loaded with fruit, and it's a very dynamic fruit, and, you know, I'll nose it again, and I'll see something different. So, you know, the Moira Vineyard, and this is still quite a young wine. This is 2024. I've tasted Chardonnays from the Moira Vineyard that are 10, 15 years old that are absolutely stunning. And so I think this is one of those wines that really reminds us how great Niagara wines can be and Beamsville Bench, because they can age for such a long time. I don't recommend that you buy a bottle and wait 15 years, but maybe buy a case and taste one every year, and you'll be really astounded.
This 7-8 years is going to be so, so good. All right, time for the Barbara Walters part of the interview. And again, I will ask this question. I will take a little bit of time, as right now Shiraz is opening one of the Gamays, and it is a screw top. So great for everyone who does not have a corkscrew. Sadly, I have more corkscrews than tools at home. I wish that was a joke. It is not. So how different would you say are you a winemaker today? Or your last couple of years before you handed that over. Last couple of years as the full-time winemaker here. How different were you then versus your first year when you went from assistant winemaker to head winemaker?
Oh, that's a great question. I think immediately I wanted to do a few different things when I first took over. Bring more fruit and freshness to the wines. So whether that was picking a little bit earlier so that the wines weren't sitting at 13.5%, 14% alcohol, I really thought, you know, 12.5 brings a really nice, pleasant feel to the wine. And I think there's a little bit more opportunity to that wine to pair with other foods. So I think that was the first thing. But I still want it to be, you know, have a really exciting fruit forward. And also, I think maybe a wine that showed off who I was as a winemaker. And as the years progressed, I realized that what identified my wines were two words, balance and purity. So I really wasn't doing anything in terms of a lot of intervention in the wine. I just sort of, you know, stewarded how the wines were progressing and made very little directional changes just to keep it on the path. And I think that once I learned that was my unique approach, that I think it took a while to figure that out, but once I did, and now, you know, it's, you can be a little bit more patient with wine, I think when you're a young winemaker, you're very nervous and you're constantly tasting and evaluating and figuring out, you know, doing the analysis. And then as you mature, you kind of just rely on gut a bit more. And I think all great winemakers, I think, get there.
Yeah, it's like when the more you do it, the more you're a leaf in the lazy river of life.
Yeah.
Knowing there's only so much you can control, but you're there for when you need to. And early on, you're probably double, triple checking because you are a little insecure. And I imagine was the first year. And I know, I'm sorry, but I'm doing the thing where I'm going back a long time, but now you're taking over and you were brought in by Ann Sperling, and I think you were assistant winemaker. I think between when you joined to when you became the head winemaker, I think it was around 5 years or so. So was that first vintage, was there a little bit more of, boy, I better not fuck this up?
Absolutely, 100%. That's still my job today. just don't fuck it up, because the fruit always comes in outstanding condition. I think I was – I actually had Anne, like, consulting with me for the first bit. So, you know, I had that experience to lean on and to make sure that the direction that – In fact, the first year, I feel like we made those wines together because, you know, she only left right before harvest. So the plans were all in place. You know, I was kind of just following the structure that we had planned on.
So the wine we have now, I know this one well. I was very happy. I got free tickets to go to or free pass for the Air Canada lounge at Pearson, and I saw your wine. I'm like, oh, this is what I'm gonna be hanging out with for the next 45 minutes before I have to make my gate. So which Gamay is this?
This is our Gamay, Niagara Peninsula Gamay. So this is the one that Dan is working on right now. Obviously not the vintage that he's working on. This is the 2024. Yeah, really, really thrilled that this wine got chosen to be in the Maple Leaf lounges at the Air Canada gates of a couple airports, to really showcase, you know, what Ontario can do with the right grape variety. And this is also a wine that you can find readily available at the LCBO as well, for a steal at something like less than $22, in my opinion. It's a beautiful wine, and it really showcases when you get the right grape growing in your climate, and you realize there's nobody else really doing this other than Beaujolais. There's some Gamay grown throughout Europe, you know, outside of Beaujolais, outside of the Loire, and even into outside of France. But nobody else around the world is really doing this. You know, everyone's chasing Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. But Niagara has Gamay, and nobody else does it like we do it. And even the winemakers of Beaujolais who come here, they're so impressed with what we can do with it. I've learned a lot from those wines as well. And so it's a very fruit forward wine, but we can do so many fun things with it. It's my favorite grape to work with.
What for you defines a good glass of Malivoire Gamay, either at the different, I mean, there's different price points, so there's different things you're going to be looking for.
Yeah, for sure. It's, you know, it's aromatically, it's gorgeous. It's a fruit bomb. You know, you feel like you're just sticking your nose in a bunch of brambleberries, which is a mix of blueberries and raspberries and blackberries, and it's just got all those, that different fruit that just sort of jumps at you. And then after that, it's just it's energetic. You know, it's the acidity is there. There's the fruit comes at you right away. It's a light bodied red, so there's not tannin, even though there's some oak aging that goes on here. Again, it's my oldest barrels. And when I say old, I mean really old, like 8, 10, 12 year old barrels. So it's just a place to park the wine and let it mature a little bit. But it's just all that beautiful, intense red berry fruit with sort of an almost crunchy feel to it. You know, I think this is the perfect summer red with a little bit of a chill on it. You can't go wrong.
We'll pause for a second because I see corks, so no point mangling it. So we'll move on to the next one. And yeah, like it's a great Gamay. And to add to it, there is a little bit of the spice. And yes, there is the exuberant red fruit, but there is a little bit of the broody dark fruit as well. It's a nice sort of tussle that's going on between them. So we will... Actually, you know what? I'll just keep yammering first. I'll just yammer as we're getting poured the... I believe that is a...
Genova.
I was going to say Nova. That sounds like a used car. So we are now having the
Nova. The Chevy Nova.
Yes, exactly. Chevy Nova. The 87 Chevy Nova. I don't think they do a Chevy Nova now. So this is, what's the difference between the Genova? Wait, Genova?
Genova.
The 2024 Genova Gamay. What's the difference between that and the last one we had?
Yeah, so this is a single vineyard Gamay.
Right.
This is actually from the Vine Mount Ridge. That's a sub-appellation above the escarpment. So not bench, but just at the edge of the escarpment. So you're actually sitting right on top of the dolomitic limestone of the Niagara Escarpment. And it's also a cooler site because you're a little further from the lake. And you're just at a higher elevation, you tend to be a lot cooler. And I think that's really fun. You know, cool. It really makes this wine a lot more crunchy and gives it a lot more tension. But it also really intensifies the fruit flavor. So the yields are really low on this site. So we get a lot of real intensity too. So between the intensity of fruit and the crunchiness of the acidity, it's just like a wow kind of wine.
I want to go. Does this feel more Loire or more Beaujolais? Like, that's the really sort of like douchey wine question. By the way, sometimes I don't like asking that question because nothing needs to be defined by France. Everything just needs to be defined by, you know, where we are in Niagara.
Yeah, absolutely. 100% agree. And we're discovering all those different expressions of our area in Ontario through all these wines, through different winemakers. And it's really exciting to see how different these wines can be. This one has become a real fan favorite of guests to the winery and our club, which is great. I should make a plug for our club if you really want to get to know Malivar well.
But wait a minute, Shiraz. I want to be a member of the Malivar Wine Club. How would I do that?
It's fantastic. You just go to our website, and there is a page that describes and answers all the questions. There's probably 20 frequently asked questions that are answered on there. So you know everything about what you're getting into. But the beautiful thing is you get wine delivered to your door 4 times a year. And it's always different stuff. But you can kind of design it for your taste. So real great opportunity.
Websites, what's that? Where would I type in my computer to get to the Malivar website?
Really?
what's the website address?
Don't you just talk to the phone and say Malivar and then it'll take you right there?
I don't do that voice to text thing. I still angrily type on my phone I hate typing because I miss the BlackBerry. But what is the website for people?
Yeah, Malivar.com. There you go. Very easy.
So there the now we're going to the Courtney Gamay 2022. So this has a little bit more age on it. And I imagine, is Courtney named after a vineyard?
Yes. So it's actually named after a block within our estate vineyard. So when you travel to the winery, you look above those Pinot Noir vines that we use for sparkling. And on top of that is our Courtney Gamay.
I may interrupt for a quick second. Yeah. If anyone who goes, oh, I can't tell the difference, one wine versus the other, you stick your nose in this wine, it smells so different from the first two. You're getting a much more serious experience.
Yeah. So what we love about this site is the grapes tend to just hang beautifully. And that might be, you know, winemaker lingo, but that just means that the fruit continues to ripen. It doesn't break down. And you can really extend the time that the grapes are developing more fruit, or maybe not more fruit, but different kind of expression of fruit. So we take advantage of that and pick it as late as we can. We also spend a little bit more time on the skins. And then just to kind of complete this whole full circle, we give it a little bit more time in barrel with a little bit more new oak. So you're just amping up everything. But we can do that because of the site.
Right. That if you choose Gamay in a lesser site and you try to do these things, it would be so overwhelmed. You're not tasting the fruit. You're tasting the winemaking.
Yeah.
That's certainly not the case here. This is the brooding Gamay.
Yeah.
This is the, you can have it with food, or if you want to have it on its own as you are staring out in, you know, into the ocean and contemplating life. Like, this is a very serious Gamay.
Yeah, this really drives at home how great Gamay can be and how versatile and how different you can make Gamay. This is deep and dark, like you say. This has got length. This is warmth. This is like a warm hug. And Gamay usually doesn't give you that at all. Sometimes it's a punch in the face, in a good way, you know. Yeah. It's a wake up.
Yeah.
But not this one. This one is like, yeah, this is a real elegant dinner date.
And once again, it just reminds you just about the site and about all the different soils that we've tried three Gamays. They could not be more different. And just, yeah, damn impressive there. So what was the inspiration for you to move on from winemaker to all the variety of titles that you now hold at Malbar? Well, what was the motivation?
Well, essentially our winemaker, who has just recently moved west, she had been Elisa Matsi. She had been working with me since 2011, became assistant winemaker, I think 2 years later after that. She was running the sparkling program. And you know, when you have someone who's in that position for 10 years, it's like, you know what? They probably have higher aspirations, and it felt like the right time to step aside and let her take the reins. It also happened to time in with our previous general manager moving on. Mm-hmm. And so we just sort of slid, both of us slid up a little bit in roles. And I think that was a really nice opportunity for her, and a great opportunity for me to learn a lot more about the other end of the business. But right now I'm back in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, you know, it'll be a short term, but I'm really enjoying getting into barrels and tasting and making blends again. So yeah, hence all the hats, including getting to hang out with you on a Wednesday morning.
Cheers. This is great. Yeah. By the way, we are close to an hour now doing this.
Oh shoot.
Yeah, I know. I feel bad because like you're busy. You got a ton of hats.
Well, we'll have one more wine after this,
okay,
and then we're good.
We'll have one more after this. So then I'll ask you a fun. Actually, no, tell about the wine, and then I got a fun goofy question.
Yeah.
For
okay.
You.
This is our Pinot Noir from 2023. We grow Pinot Noir on three sites: my own farm, the Moira Vineyard, and the Estate Vineyard. You know, I think what's beautiful is when you can really celebrate single vineyards, but with Pinot Noir, you already have such a complex wine. But to add more layers of complexity by taking from different sites really fulfills this wine into what a complete picture. And I think it's one of the more gorgeous Pinot Noirs. It's a little bit, you know, in typical Pinot Noir fashion, the color has a little bit of a brick tone to it. But again, really, really rich, velvety texture. I'm just taking a nose. There's a beautiful kind of combination of fruit and earthiness. Again, everything you want to see in Pinot Noir. I think it's a beautiful expression.
Yeah, it is. And it reminds you of the best versions of Pinot. It reminds you of Hidden Bench, Batchelder, Kelly Mason. Like there is, it's funny, there is a benchmark of what the top levels of Pinot taste like. And this certainly falls there. And nerdy question before fun question. The number one biggest difference when it comes to making Gamay versus making Pinot. Maybe this is in the vineyard or in the winery.
I love this question, because if you had asked me this question 15 years ago, I would have said, there's no difference. I make Gamay like I make Pinot Noir. You know, I do stem, I do a cold soak. You know, I go for an extended maceration, minimum of 14 days. Maybe I can push it out to 20 days on the skins before I press it. And then I age it in, you know, 10 to 20% new oak for about, you know, 12 to 14 months. That's how I made Pinot Noir and how I made Gamay. And then all of a sudden, it's like, I tried making Gamay a different way and totally changed. And now it's even affected how I make Pinot Noir. So Gamay, a minimum of 30, one-third whole cluster in the vat. So you layer that in, so you get a little bit of what we call carbonic maceration happening, where the fermentation is not by the yeast, but it's enzymatic, and you get a very different floral note. So you add that to the mix. The maturation is very short in barrel. Ideally, I like to see 4 to 6 months tops in Gamay so that you really keep that vibrancy. So now they're made completely different.
That's funny. But that also goes back to earlier about how different you are a winemaker now versus then.
Exactly.
Like just learning and growing like that.
Yeah.
So my last question for you, because I've taken up way too much of your time, is you went on the Two Guys Talking Wine podcast. Those jerks, Andre and Pincus.
Oh, Pincus. Pincus. You know, and it's funny you say that because we always refer to, when we say, you know, Michael Pincus, it's just like Pincus.
Yeah. And depending on the mood, the tone, the way you say that word. So you had to do blind Gamay tasting. When I was just doing my research, I saw you were on with them. I haven't listened to that episode yet. How did that go? How did the blind tasting go?
Oh, they threw a couple curveballs at me for sure. And you know, I wasn't expecting, okay, I was expecting some of our own wines, but I wasn't expecting that they were going to pull our Gamay that they bought at the LCBO back in 2012. So it was something like a 12-year-old wine at that point, 13-year-old wine. And I didn't get it. B, I thought it was way younger than it was, and it was tasting great. And so the revelation there was, wow, Gamay can still look good that long in. I mean, it certainly isn't the style that I would want it presented in, but I was really impressed that. So if you do have like some old Malivore Gamay bottles sitting in your cellar and you're worried that they're toast, take a chance. Maybe they're great.
And also just goes against the myth of, oh, Gamay, you got to drink it young. It shows, again, the terroir and the winemaking that you can have a Gamay that was 14 years old and was still drinking really, really well.
Yeah, absolutely. The one Gamay we tasted, the Courtney Gamay that already had a bit of age, that's the kind of wine, again, does do very well after 5 to 10 years. And I would certainly recommend checking that out. But to have something that was stored under Stelvin for that long was just really impressive.
We end with the Cab Franc. Seems weird, we're ending with the Cab Franc, but a grape that is so much bigger and more important in Niagara now than it was 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
So what attracted you guys to this varietal?
Well, interestingly, I've been working with Cab Franc for so many years for our Ladybug Rosé. And I have access to some great sites. And slowly, I convinced Martin I wanted to do a red Cab Franc. It took a few years to get the green light on that. And the first couple ones, I may not have made a very good one, but you know, you got to fail a few times before you succeed. And this fruit comes from the 20 Mile Bench, which is there's two abutting farms right by Balls Falls, and one is run by the Wismer family, and that's the majority of it. It's fantastic. So it's sitting on top of that limestone, but it's on the sandy soil, so you get this really intense fruit. I say that a lot, so you know, I'm sure you're listening, and it's like, oh, you said it's intense fruit again, you know. So it's hard to describe, you know, the differences, but you have to nose it and try. And this one has got some really ripe berry notes with a little bit of pepperiness too, which I just love. So there's this back and forth that, you know, it's I don't know. It's got this darkness to it that I really love, this rustic note. And Cab Franc, the success of these Cab Francs have inspired us to plant Cab Franc in our own vineyards. And in the next, last year we had our first crop, and I think it's going to be, for us, it's going to join Pinot Noir and Gamay as our holy trinity of reds at Malvar.
As we end this, first off, appreciate you so much doing this. We've gone an hour, so it was well worth the wait. I can't believe we haven't done this earlier. And again, Shiraz, congratulations on all your success. Going from just someone who loved food, started to dabble in wine, going to Brock, coming here. For people who don't know, there are certain names that are synonymous with Niagara wine, with the growth of it, the popularity of it. And you're part of it. You're part of the foundation of this area. So I really appreciate the time. I'm thrilled to chat with you. I love your success. And I can't wait to keep drinking your wines. Thanks so much for being on the pod.
Awesome, Matt. Pleasure to have you here. We won't wait 4 years until the next time.
Hopefully not. Thanks so much for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Apple, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.